Welcome to Business Spotlight on Money Radio WPSE. Business Spotlight is heard weekly at this time on 1450 AM and 107.1 FM. Today's guest is Dr. Mario Kinsella, sleep physician at UPMC Hammett. Doctor, thanks so much for joining us. Can you share a little bit about your background and what led you to UPMC Hammett?
I'm originally Irish, as you can gather from the way I talk. I did my training in the University of British Columbia in Vancouver in Canada. And while there I did pulmonary medicine, and one of our leaders in pulmonary medicine was a very enthusiastic sleep researcher. And that got me interested peripherally in sleep, although my main specialty was pulmonary medicine. I then went to West Virginia for a year and a half, and during which time I went on a sleep medicine course at Stanford University in California. And there I met a physician who was working in Pittsburgh at the time. He said to me, "We're looking for somebody to join our group. Would you like to join our group?" So I did. And I ended up staying in Pittsburgh for 23 years. I was in a large 7-member multi-specialty group. We did pulmonary medicine, sleep medicine, and critical care medicine. Over the years, we found private practice becoming increasingly difficult because our reimbursements went down every year and our expenses went up, and eventually the two just couldn't work together. So I realized that I needed an alternative. And while I was looking for an alternative to this group, this opportunity in Erie came up in 2015. And I came and started a new group in 2015. The reason was that the pulmonary group in Hammett Hospital, UPMC Hammett, were bought by Highmark. And there was a concern that Highmark may pull them out because of the competition that was going on at the time between the two organizations. So Hammett realized that they had to found their own pulmonary group in case the pulmonary doctors who were already there were not able to service the hospital anymore. So I came up to start a new program in 2015 on my own. And sort of, as they say, the rest is history. The doctors did eventually pull out of Hammett and went and now only cover St. Vincent's Hospital. And our group has taken over the pulmonary medicine service at Hammett Hospital, inpatient and outpatient. And we have a very large expanding group of physicians. We're actually moving, as you know, this is our office. We're moving tomorrow to a new office, which is a custom-built refurbishment of part of the cancer center. And we'll have approximately 7,000 square feet of office space there, which will be much improved over our small office space here, which was fine when I came here on my own to run an outpatient service, but now with 7 providers, it's not tenable anymore, so we have to move.
Why is getting the right amount of sleep so important?
We need sleep for many reasons. As I said earlier, one of the most important functions of sleep is as memory consolidator. So we don't get adequate sleep, our memory is impaired. Plus, we know ourselves that we don't sleep adequately. We don't feel well the next day. We don't function properly, mentally or physically. So most of us have a lot of us have mental jobs that require mental agility. If we don't get adequate sleep, we can't perform that job adequately. And there's very good evidence showing that people who get inadequate sleep, such as residents in the old days, who worked day after day after day with no sleep or little sleep, were not functioning at an adequate level to perform their duties. So now there's restriction on the number of hours residents can work. These are trainee physicians. And we know that surgeons, if they're up all night, then have to operate the next day without sleep, they're performing inadequately. I personally would not like to have my heart operated on at 7 a.m. by a doctor who spent 3 hours in the OR operating somebody during the night who didn't sleep. And we know that these people don't perform at the level required of them. And we know that pilots don't perform adequately if they don't get adequate sleep. So we need sleep to so-called restore ourselves. But exactly what restoring is, we don't know, except a memory function. But we have to get restorative sleep because we have to function the next day. Without adequate and proper sleep, we don't function properly the following day, or the following week, or the following month, or the following year. So it's required on an ongoing basis to function properly, mentally and physically. We have to get sleep.
How prevalent is sleep apnea today?
It's extremely common. It probably occurs in about 15% of adult men and in about 8% of adult women, and becoming more common. Now, you mentioned about it being undiagnosed. Probably, we think we've probably diagnosed about 5% of patients who've got sleep apnea in the United States. So 95% of those with the condition, we think, have not been diagnosed. Now, the first description of this came back in the 1960s, although there's a frequent misnomer in some medical terms about it condition called Pickwickian syndrome. In one of Charles Dickens' short stories in the Pickwick Papers, he makes reference to a character in the book called the Fat Boy, who was sleepy. Now, it's presumed that the Fat Boy probably was a child, a teenager, with obstructive sleep apnea. Now, wives have been diagnosing this condition for hundreds of years, but it first was diagnosed medically in the 1960s, and there was no treatment at the time. Now, in the late 60s, they realized that if they performed a tracheostomy, that is, make a hole in the neck and allow an opening there, you could bypass the blockage, and that was the treatment of sleep apnea until 1984. In 1984, an Australian chap called Colin Sullivan described a treatment called continuous positive airway pressure. Basically, he described placing a mask on the face attached to a small machine, which is really just an air pump that blows air in under pressure. And by blowing air in the nose, you could force the soft palate and the tongue forward, which is a blockage in the airway, and by using that treatment, overcome the obstruction and blockage to the airway. And that was the first widely used successful treatment for sleep apnea, apart from tracheostomy. And we still use nasal CPAP widely and by far the most common treatment for treating obstructive sleep apnea. Other treatments for obstructive sleep apnea can include dental devices. There are a number of dental devices, which are basically our fancy custom-made mouth guards that are fitted by dentists who work in sleep, and there are some here in town. The idea is there's a hinge between the top and the bottom part of the mouth guard, which you put in at night time to try and push the lower jaw forward. And by moving the tongue and all the muscles in the floor of the mouth forward, you can open up the blockage at the back of the tongue. And people who have what we call mild to moderate sleep apnea, this can be a very successful form of treatment. Alternatively, surgery is another option that's used, although I don't send many patients for surgery anymore. I used to, but not now. I don't send many. The role of surgery in treating obstructive sleep apnea, I think, is a little unclear. We're not really quite sure what the role is. One of the downsides is, to cure sleep apnea, most patients will require multiple procedures. And upper airway surgery, I understand, is very unpleasant. I haven't had it done, but I believe it's very uncomfortable. So many patients, therefore, will shy away from a process where they may have to have multiple procedures. There are other newer ideas as well. There's a treatment called hypoglossal nerve stimulation, which basically means the hypoglossal nerve is the nerve that controls the tongue. And by using essentially a pacemaker and implanting a wire in the base of the tongue, by contracting the tongue muscle, you can move the tongue slightly forward and open up the airway as you're breathing in when sleeping. It's becoming more popular. There's nobody here does it locally, but it is becoming more widely used in those who can't tolerate CPAP or can't tolerate dental devices. Medication may be used at some stage for treating sleep apnea, although so far that hasn't gone anywhere. If you think about it, what's happening in obstructive sleep apnea is the upper airway muscle tone control is abnormal. In high blood pressure, the muscle tone control of the blood vessels is abnormal. So in sleep apnea, the muscle tone control in the upper airway is abnormal. Therefore, can we direct a medication at the cortex of the brain, the outside lining of the brain, that may be able to affect the muscle tone control of the airway? The theory is there. So far, it hasn't come out positive. There have been some studies that have not been successful. But ultimately, that's going to be, I think, the long-term treatment of sleep apnea. Obviously, it's evolving. As I said, CPAP came out first in 1984. That's 35 years ago. So we presume that not many treatments in medicine have lasted 35 years. It's been tweaked in the sense that the machines are much better, much smaller, much quieter, much more efficient. The mask engineering has improved markedly over the past 35 years. Remember that there's several huge companies worldwide that make machinery for treating sleep apnea. It's a multi-billion dollar industry, and these companies are hiring the best engineers out of the best engineering schools in the world to make this equipment better all the time. So the three major players, including Respironics, Philips, which is a Western Pennsylvania company, are working on getting these as efficient and as effective as possible. Although I think ultimately we'd be going into medication at some stage. When, I don't know.
Doctor, what is the average sleep requirement and what kind of improvement does a treated sleep disorder experience?
Well, the average sleep requirement in an adult in the United States is between 7 and 9 hours. And we have this, as I said earlier, it's called an intrinsic sleep need, which you can't change. Your body requires a certain amount of hours of sleep to to be restorative. And this sleep need is intrinsic. It's not something we can alter. It's fixed. Now, if you don't get that adequate sleep, you don't function properly the following day, and you may feel run down or inadequate, and you're not functioning adequately. People who have conditions like obstructive sleep apnea are more likely to develop high blood pressure. So therefore, we think it's important to look for and hence treat this condition called obstructive sleep apnea. If you treat it, blood pressure is easier to control. Your chance of heart irregularities is less. If you have heart irregularity called atrial fibrillation, your chance of atrial fibrillation is reduced, not abolished, but reduced by treating your sleep apnea. We hope you feel better, although a certain percentage of people don't feel any improvement when we treat their sleep apnea. We're not quite sure why. They're still as sleepy. They're still feeling no improvement after treatment. There's not much life extension improvement by treating sleep apnea, which we thought there should be, but there isn't. We don't reduce the incidence of heart disease or heart attacks by treating sleep apnea. Although we do improve blood pressure control, which of course helps you control your chance of getting a heart attack. So we hope that people, by treating it, will feel better, wake up more refreshed in the daytime. Their spouses, of course, are happy because they're not snoring anymore. And we hope they function better in the daytime and have less chance of developing high blood pressure and its consequences. That's why we think it's important to look for and treat. Remember, if you're sleepy, what we do every day, like driving, can become extremely dangerous. One of the dangers, of course, of sleepiness while driving is that you can fall asleep. Now, if you think about it, at 60 miles an hour, you're traveling 88 feet per second. If you fall asleep for 1 second, and that's not long, dozing, you've traveled almost 30 yards in 1 second. You can do an awful lot of damage in a car in 30 yards. So we think, therefore, if you're sleepy in the daytime, driving is not advisable until your sleepiness has been diagnosed and treated. One of the dangers of driving when you're sleepy is you can fall asleep without feeling sleepy. And if you think about when you're driving, sometimes you're on a freeway and you sort of think, I missed my exit, what happened? Did you sleep? Maybe. Were you having a momentary lapse of sleep as you passed the exit? It's quite possible. And many people have had this experience. So if you're driving at 60 miles an hour, that's 30 yards you've gone in 1 second. So we may have had these so-called micro sleeps while we're driving. Extremely dangerous. So we therefore think that treating excess sleepiness is extremely important. And therefore having your required sleep is important for doing simple tasks like driving. And we also know that your reflexes are not as efficient when you're driving if you're sleep deprived or not sleeping adequately. There's some fairly old work now from the 1980s showing that sleepy drivers drive the same as drunk drivers. Their reflexes are slower as are drunk drivers. Their responses are slower as are drunk drivers. They swerve on the road like drunk drivers do. So they drive very similar to drunk driving. Now, we don't have a breathalyzer test for measuring your degree of sleepiness. There isn't one, so therefore it can't be done. But it is as dangerous to drive while sleepy as it is while drinking.
Doctor, when do you know you have a problem and you need to see a physician?
Well, first of all, there are a number of symptoms of obstructive sleep apnea that spouses and patients can look for. Perpetual snoring, that's snoring a lot of times. If you feel you get adequate sleep at nighttime, now what does adequate sleep mean? Whatever your sleep requirement is, you wake up in the morning feeling tired. If you're tired or sleepy in the daytime, and if you find that you wake up in the morning time and you have a headache. Headache in the morning is very common in patients who have obstructive sleep apnea. If your spouse says you snore like a train, you thrash around all night time, and you stop breathing, you probably have obstructive sleep apnea. If you're on 3 medications or more for hypertension, your high blood pressure is poorly controlled, we have to look for obstructive sleep apnea. So if you have symptoms that a spouse or you notice is snoring, poorly refreshing sleep, daytime sleepiness, morning headache, objectively reported breathing pauses, i.e. spouse notices you're stopping breathing, you probably have obstructive sleep apnea and should be looked at. Now, traditionally in the old days meaning prior to 10 years ago, we diagnosed obstructive sleep apnea always by bringing somebody into the sleep center for a night. Now, the American Academy of Sleep Medicine announced about 10 years ago that that's still the traditional way of diagnosing obstructive sleep apnea. But if a patient clinically has moderate to severe obstructive sleep apnea, a test called a home sleep apnea test can be performed. A home sleep apnea test measures a limited number of parameters. We basically look for breathing, oxygen level, heart rate and rhythm while you're sleeping. We're not measuring if you're awake or asleep, although some tests do. What we use locally, here we don't measure awake or sleep. So it tends to underestimate the number of times you stop breathing per hour, because we're measuring number of times you stop breathing per hour of test as opposed to per hour of sleep. So we don't know if you're awake or asleep. So if you're watching TV for an hour with the equipment on, obviously you don't know if you're awake or asleep during that time. And in patients who have suspected moderate to severe obstructive sleep apnea, this is a reasonable alternative to performing a test in the sleep center. Now currently we have over 40 sets of equipment locally here that we use in UPMC Hammett for home testing. And we're not doing as many home tests as we'd like, mainly because patients forget to bring the equipment back, and so it's stuck out of people's houses for weeks, if not months at a time. But it is a very effective way. It's not always adequate because there's no control over whether the equipment is on correctly, even though they're shown how to put it on. If it's not on correctly, we don't know. There's no one looking at it during the night to see if it's adequate or still recording. And we get about a third of our tests back are inadequate because of that. Although I think as time goes on, that will get better. And so we're doing more and more home testing for that. Certain times you can't test at home. For example, if you're looking for something else apart from obstructive sleep apnea, you can't do a home test. It's only some people call it, it's called a home sleep test, but some will actually refer to it as a home sleep apnea test, which I prefer. Then it's only looking for one condition. There's other conditions as well, of course, that are seen in sleep medicine. And I want to talk a little bit about narcolepsy. Narcolepsy is a very interesting condition, relatively uncommon, although I have a number of patients that I see. What we see is you see features of wakefulness interfering with sleep, features of sleep interfering with wakefulness. Remember, sleep has several stages, and we have to go through these stages in an orderly manner in order to get refreshment from sleep. Sleep stages are called N1, N2, N3, and are REM sleep. REM stands for rapid eye movement sleep. This is the stage of sleep when we dream. During REM sleep, three things are happening. Number one, you're asleep. Number two, your eyes are moving rapidly, which we can see behind the eyelids, and we also measure this in the sleep center. And thirdly, you're paralyzed. The reason your muscle tone is low is that if you're not paralyzed during REM sleep, you will act out your dreams. And there is a condition where that happens. It's not very common, but I do see it every now and again. It's called REM behavior disorder. So we want to be paralyzed during REM sleep, or we'll act out. And if you think about some of our dreams are a bit odd, acting them out can be very strange. Now, remembering those three features of REM sleep, we can see these conditions, these things happening in the daytime when we're awake. Number one, with narcolepsy, you're sleepy. And to give you an example, I had a patient several years ago who was a high school football player. He would lie down on the side of the field and have a 15-minute nap and feel wonderful. Typically, patients with narcolepsy who nap get very good refreshment from their nap. That's number one, they are sleepy. Number two, they're paralyzed in REM sleep. So we can get paralysis in the daytime. This condition is called cataplexy. Paralysis can be global. I had a patient several years ago whose children knew she had narcolepsy. They wanted her to stop bugging them. It would make her angry. When she got angry, she would become paralyzed, fall on a heap on the floor. And these episodes of cataplexy generally last less than 1 minute. It can be also local. I've had patients who had the side of her face would droop when she got a cataplectic attack. Arms can become weak, a leg can become weak, or it can be global paralysis, which generally lasts 1 to 2 minutes. It can be quite frightening. And obviously cataplexy while driving can be very dangerous. And thirdly, of course, in REM sleep, you're dreaming. We can get these hallucinations in the daytime as we're falling asleep. They're called hypnagogic hallucinations. It basically means the dream of REM sleep is starting as you're falling asleep. You're starting to dream before you fall asleep. Again, it can be quite frightening. The other feature of narcolepsy, which we sometimes see, is called sleep paralysis. Remember, typically REM sleep or dream sleep occurs late in the night. We have several sessions of REM sleep which tend to occur later at night. So we often wake up in REM sleep in the morning time. That's why you remember your dreams when you wake up in the morning. Now, if you have narcolepsy, that paralysis of the dream sleep or REM sleep may continue after you wake up and can last as long as 1 or 2 minutes. It can be quite frightening, because number one, you can't move. And number two, because you're paralyzed, your muscle tone is low, you're not breathing as deeply as you normally would. so you can feel short of breath and can be quite distressing until it goes away. Sometimes you had a dream of dream sleep can persist after you wake up. It's called hypnopompic hallucination, although it's very uncommon. We see it rarely, but we do see it sometimes. So these features of REM sleep can occur out of context. So patients who have narcolepsy, typically we'll see the excess sleepiness plus or minus cataplexy. And they have, paradoxically then, they can have disrupted sleep at night time. You say, I'm really sleepy in the daytime, but I don't sleep properly at night time. And it's typical, we're seeing wakefulness features, i.e. they're waking up at night, interfering with their sleep, and the sleep features interfering with the wakefulness hours. Now we diagnose their narcolepsy is diagnosed by doing a sleep test in the sleep center, obviously to exclude other conditions like sleep apnea, and then we perform what's called a multiple sleep latency test, where we keep the patient in the sleep center for the day, and every 2 hours we allow them to have a nap. The nap period can last as long as 20 minutes. We're looking in that for two things. One, how sleepy are they objectively? How long does it take to fall asleep? And there are defined abnormalities. There's a definition of what excess sleepiness means. And are they going into REM sleep? Now, generally speaking, when you sleep, your first REM period occurs within 70 to 120 minutes after you fall asleep. Now, if you have a 20-minute nap or 15-minute nap, you're not supposed to have a REM period. So we're looking for REM sleep occurring in a nap, which is abnormal. And that's how we define, how we diagnose this condition called narcolepsy. Narcolepsy, fortunately, has some very good treatment options nowadays, both for the sleepiness in the daytime and for the cataplexy. It can be treated similar, the same way, or there are special treatments, depending on which symptom is more severe. And we also try and get people who have narcolepsy, if possible, if they need a nap, to get a nap. There's nothing wrong with having a nap in the daytime if you're sleepy, particularly if you have a diagnosed sleep disorder. And we sometimes have to work with employers to allow patients to have a brief nap, 15-20 minute nap in the daytime, which I see nothing wrong with. It's far more efficient to have a patient get a 15-minute nap and feel normal than be zombied and inefficient in the daytime. It's also much safer if they're having a driving occupation, if they have a job where they have to function mentally or physically, to have that nap and feel better.
What are your thoughts on OTC meds and prescribed sleep aids to try and solve the issue?
There's two issues here, I think. One is, what are we treating and why are we treating it? The reason why many of us have difficulty sleeping at nighttime is because something is happening. For example, if our spouse gets ill or a parent dies, we're going to have difficulty sleeping. That's a temporary, short-term thing. The second reason some of us have difficulty sleeping is what we call poor sleep hygiene. That's probably by far the commonest reason why people have difficulty sleeping at nighttime. We sleep in a pattern, and it's a regular pattern decided around a 24-hour cycle. 24 hours because there's 24 hours in a day. If our natural intrinsic sleep requirement is from 10 p.m. to 6 a.m., that's 8 hours, going to bed one night at 8, next night at 11, next night at 1 a.m., next night at 2 a.m., getting up at 6, 7, 9, our brain says, I don't know what I'm supposed to do. It's completely confused. You can't sleep at will. You sleep when you need to sleep. So good, competent sleep hygiene is extremely important to help us get a good, adequate night of sleep. We have to have a regular sleep-wake schedule. That's the most important thing of all. Avoiding caffeine late in the afternoon. Good sleep hygiene, regular sleep, going to bedtime, very important. Regular getting up time is very important. The typical teenager of going to bed at midnight, getting up at 6 a.m. for school, and sleeping at 2 p.m. on a Saturday afternoon to try and catch up on the missed sleep during the week is not a good way and not a good sleep habit. Many people carry that into adulthood. They do the same thing. And we can't do that. If we do that, our brain has no idea what it's supposed to do. The chemicals it reduces become willy-nilly. They forget when they're supposed to be reduced or released. And therefore, we look for help in chemical help and trying to find some aid at nighttime to help us sleep. There are a number of medications which can be used to help you sleep at nighttime. Some of them over-the-counter, some prescribed. I don't like to prescribe sleep medication long-term. Obviously, sleeping medications, they're known as hypnotics, are very helpful in the short term. In other words, why is the patient having difficulty sleeping? Treat that, good sleep hygiene, and then maybe they might require a chemical aid for a week or two, by which time their pattern should be back to normal and they should not require it long term. Sleeping medications also are not a good idea in patients who may have breathing disorders, especially sleep apnea, obstructive sleep apnea particularly, because it tends to make it worse. If you have a sleeping medication, it tends to reduce muscle tone. If you reduce muscle tone, you reduce your airway muscle tone, and your obstructive sleep apnea will actually get worse. So therefore, we don't recommend treatment of sleeplessness with hypnotic medication in untreated sleep apnea. Once your sleep apnea is treated, it doesn't matter. But prior to treatment, we would not recommend that. Now, you mentioned over-the-counter aids. There are a number of over-the-counter aids. For some reason, large numbers of them are combined with Tylenol. I don't understand the thinking there, because it has no effect on sleep. So why you'd want to put a medication in with acetaminophen, it baffles me, I don't know. Certainly, they can be very helpful in short-term use if you're having difficulty sleeping for a reason. But the most important thing about difficulty sleeping at nighttime is to find out why. What's the reason? And if you find a reason, you reverse the reason. Obviously, if you have pain from rheumatoid arthritis, getting sleep medication is not the answer. It's treat the pain from the rheumatoid arthritis. If you have chronic back pain, getting sleep medication is not helpful. Treat the back pain. If you have depression, treating just making you sleep is not the answer. It's find out why are you depressed. Is this something which requires medication? Treat the reason. By treating the reason, you'll often overcome the sleep problem. And then treat the reason, and then get good sleep. Very good sleep hygiene is vitally important.
For the person that is affected with a sleep disorder, what would you say in terms of taking the steps to actually get treated?
Well, the initial diagnosis is for the patient. If you think you may have a sleep disorder, talk to your doctor about it. Number two, doctors need to be more cognizant of the fact that patients are spending one third of their lives in bed. How is your sleep? It's very simple to take. We ask patients about how their blood pressure is, how their diet is, how their weight is, how their exercise is. Ask them how their sleep is. Do you sleep well at nighttime? Do you snore? Does your wife complain of your snoring? Do you wake up tired or refreshed in the morning time? Are you tired or sleepy in the daytime? Those four questions take me approximately 25 seconds to talk about. It's the same in a doctor's office, 25 seconds. It's not too much in a busy schedule. So if people are cognizant of the fact that you may have a sleep disorder and ask about your sleep, it's one third of your life. Think about it, ask about it, and as a patient, think about your sleep and how important it is and how useful it is for you and for your future and for your present.
You know, doctor, there's a lot of watches that kind of tell you how much you're sleeping throughout the night. Are those accurate? And do younger people get a deeper sleep than older people?
It can't tell you deep sleep, because deep sleep is what's called, as I said, sleep is N1, N2, N3, and REM. Now, the real deep sleep is the N3 sleep. You remember when they're young, you're out somewhere, you bring them home, they're in the back of the car, they've fallen asleep. You bring them in the house, put them on the bed, take off the clothes, put on their PJs, they are completely comatose. They're N3 sleep. Now, as you get older, you get less and less N3 sleep, and it's not as deep as it was, and so you're more easily aroused. But those kids, they're comatose from N3 sleep. That's deep sleep. I don't get any of that anymore. You guys don't get much either. You get less as you get older. Now, we're not measuring, but you're getting less. It's a normal feature of age. But kids get very intense, very deep N3 sleep. Now, you can't get only that sleep. All sleep stages are required for refreshment in an orderly manner. You can't just go have 3 hours of N1, 2 hours of N2, and an hour of N3, and you're going to feel great. It doesn't work like that. You go through sleep in an orderly, in different stages of sleep, going N1, and N1 really is the falling asleep stage. What I call it the twilight zone, where you can actually wake up. N2, N3, and REM are really the restorative stages of sleep, and we go through them in an orderly manner. We have several REM stages. Most of our sleep is N2. We have some N3 sleep, which is the really deep sleep, which is seen very intensely in children. And the brain waves are much larger in children and young people than they are in older people of the N3 sleep, what are called delta waves. And it's a certain defined type of wave that you see when you measure the brainwave patterns for measuring sleep. They're very intense, very large, big waves in children, and they get smaller and less intense as you get older. And so does the N3 sleep get less intense. But that's the really deep sleep that children, young people, tend to get much more than older people.
Thanks for listening to Business Spotlight on Money Radio WPSE. Business Spotlight is heard Fridays at 12:30 p.m. and Saturday at 9 a.m. Join us again next week as the Erie Regional Chamber and Growth Partnership is in the Business Spotlight.